Today is Sunday, December 4th, 2005, and this is LA Lit number 6. LA Lit records interviews and conversations with poets and writers both native to and passing through Los Angeles. LA Lit is more than just a show. It's a place for the literary culture of Los Angeles to exhibit itself. I'm your co-host, Stephanie Ryu.
And I'm Matthew Timmons. Just want to mention that we're sponsored by Super Bunker. You can visit them at superbunker.com, and we're recording this show at Beta Level. This is where we typically record the shows on Sunday nights at 5 p.m., and you can go to betalevel.com. There's information about LA Lit on both of those pages, and we do now have a website up, la-lit.com, and we're here tonight with Amar Rava.
Hi, Amar.
Hi.
Amar is a local poet and writer. He has poetry published in several literary journals, among them Interlope, a journal of Asian American poetics, the Berkeley Poetry Review, and Nocturnes, on which he also serves as an advisor. He also has work forthcoming in Trepan, the anthology Risen from the East, the Poetry of the Non-Western World, and Writing the Lives of Our Hands. He's currently teaching at Glendale Community College, and you can find out more about him on his website, videopoetics.org. Tonight, Amar is going to be reading from his work, American Canyon, Document of a Snake Ritual, which combines South Indian and Californian history, memoir, poetry, documentary, and compassion.
And just for our listeners, Amar kind of incorporates video work with his text, and there will be videos posted on the website, which you can watch, and along with listening to the audio from the show. And I think right now we're just going to launch into his first reading. Amar, if you want to take it away.
The water stains the edge of my towel green. I splash it 3 times in my face. There's no way I will put my head under this water. There isn't even a lotus flower in the tank. I know millions of Hindus have done this before me, here at this very tank. Their dirt floats before it settles. I turn around to see Ravi approach the water's edge. He gestures for me to immerse myself. I take another step further down, close my eyes, and dunk my head. I do this 3 times because of tradition, and 1 more time just in case. I open my eyes to reflections of palm trees holding their green fruit. The water has a salty taste of the ocean. It bloats the cotton around my waist with weight. I walk past the video camera and disappear into the world it can't see. I try to change discreetly, but drop my towel, and Ravi yells chi-chi in embarrassment. A family of 7, with their backs turned, face a pujari wearing a cream shawl split by a green stripe thrown over his shoulder. They perform the rites for the death of a family member, repeating what he says in Sanskrit. They say this tirtham is that strong. It can cleanse away death. As they dry, the sky grows blue around them. In 1983, I was sweating in the shade of a sky blue room. On the floor was a small jumping spider, rubbing its head with its front paws. I watched him for a while. He was suspicious, keeping his 8 eyes on what he thought was moving at all times. I listened to the old black circular fan here at Petitha's house in Pudli, the town where my father had grown up. Above me and standing out sharply from the background of the wall was a picture of a lightly mustached man, someone I never met. Petitha grew tired when she looked at her son, Her daughter, Radhika, took me up to the flat cement roof with piles of mud to stop the rain from leaking inside. She wore an orange-red petticoat and matching ribbons wrapped in her black hair. Her smile was perfect, one of her dimples darker than the other. Tate has found his way into my family's living room in California. He's the figure of loss. He sits in a chair in the garage next to the minivan when it rains and smokes cigarettes. In good weather, he follows the cardiovascular jogging route in the park down the street until a cigarette is finished. My sister asks in the car, "It's Rocky tomorrow. Will you stay in town so I can tie a Rocky on you?" "Yeah, but I have a lot of work to do," I said, looking at the rows of condominiums hidden behind the thin patches of eucalyptus. Rocky is the day when your siblings and cousins tie a bracelet, purple and glittery, or sometimes red and shiny gold, around your wrist, and in return you promise to protect them and give them a present. But for me, the Rocky is tied around my Bawa's wrist, an elder sibling if I had one. I asked my mother once who my Bawa was, since I didn't have an elder brother, and she told me that he was my cousin who had died a long time ago, the year I was born. A year after you were born, we went back to India. Everyone wanted to see you, so we went everywhere so they could see you. When we were in Pudeli, your aunt Petita's son was going to school outside of town. He was studious, like your father. He wanted to see you, so he left the school in a hard rain. He couldn't see the electric wire falling on the road that night in the storm. Petita always said that I was like my Bawa, her son that I had never met. In Pudeli, everyone had to step over open sewers to get to their front door, and the temple next door to us had broken shards of bottles stuck into the top of cement walls so that the monkeys couldn't perch there. Like the BART station ledges and shop fronts with metal spikes near the embarcadero so the homeless and the pigeons couldn't sleep there. The metal rails, the shards of glass. When we listen, our past is littered with elegy. I began writing it in 2000, and mostly that was prompted by me going over videotapes of stuff I had taped when I was 10, Super 8, and it reminded me of a certain time in my life, and so then I began to write down what I had seen in those videotapes. But this project finally came together when, in 2003, my mother requested that I go do a ceremony in Rameswaram, which is the southern tip of India, to deal with this thing called a Naga Dosham, which she said I have. And so I'm skeptical of those things, but I knew that it would appease her. So I went down to India and performed that ceremony. And so this text mostly has a lot to do with coming to terms with that, performing a ceremony that I might be skeptical about, and how it gives me access to where I'm from and what my family has done.
What's interesting about what you say of giving you yourself a kind of access to your history and stuff like that is that immediately, like, what you read here is like from the first 15, say, pages of your book, you know, against a backdrop of video that you shot, when you were there for the ritual, or?
Yes.
And what strikes me immediately within the first 15 pages of this book is that we get intercuts of, you know, from the first day you were born, or the year after you were born, and then we get cuts to, you know, like, say, 2003, and there's kind of this intercutting of various different times and places. And can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, one thing I believe in is the past is now, so to speak, and so I try to conflate and take down those separations of temporality. I think that myths, stories are all handed down, and when you're told them, suddenly all of that becomes very present. So I try to do that in the process of the video and my writing.
Okay. And it kind of opens up the text where, such that the reader in a way has like multiple access points. You know, you get a little bit about different times at the same time. So, but talking about these, talk to us more about these kind of myths that you develop throughout this book, especially with the snake ritual, which the book, you know, is a document of a snake ritual. Tell us a little bit about that kind of, you know, that's kind of the central myth being handed down through this book.
The Naga Dosham affects transgenerationally like a number of people in my family, and each one has done something or another to appease that. So I had to learn the stories or what they believed was the reasons why they had to do rituals too. And so each one of those stories pretty much, for me, gives me access into why I would be doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And in the same time, I'm learning about them and their history, and as well as mine.
Sure. What is a Naga Dosham?
What is a Naga Dosham?
Yep.
Well, it's not per se a curse, and it's not per se fate, but it's something that affects your life, and one can try to mitigate its effect on your life. And so it's specifically what's called prarabdha karma, which is karma that affects you during your own life, and it's considered immediate retribution for something you've done.
And so that's kind of talking about dosham part, but what is naga kind of?
Naga means snake.
Okay. And tell us the connection a little bit anyway about why necessarily a naga dosham, and I'm guessing there's various other types of, you know, dosham.
Yeah, but in the part of India that my family's from, snakes are a major environmental concern, so to speak, in the sense that they make these huge snake hills, and they're all over the place. They're really ever present. And, you know, most of them are cobras, so in a certain way, immediate retribution for, like, stepping on a snake is death, right? So one could consider that a snake does, in a lot of ways, operate in this register of how nature around you can can immediately strike you down, so to speak.
Related to that long history in that area and for your family, there's a part in this book where you say, well, where your aunt says, you should not listen to someone else's story. And this is when you're talking about the Sodi, but I thought that that was an interesting line in this book, which is so full of so many of your personal stories.
Yeah, and part of documenting this ritual, only certain parts of the ritual were, it was allowed for documentation. So there's like 3 hours missing, and that was purposeful, so that I believe that no one could actually recreate the ritual, or at least this is what the pujaris or priests had wanted, right? So it's sort of transgressive on my part to be videotaping it. And I think that it is transgressive on my part to be telling these stories too. But at the same time, there are things that are left out. I mean, it's not a complete fiction in any way. And I mean, it's not a complete document of all the stories that are told.
Does that relate to what you say about this piece having to do with compassion? What's left in and what's left out?
Yeah. I mean, compassion for me is when you consider injustice in the world and want to say something about it. And this, the whole piece has a lot to do with history that's neglected or ignored and how it affects our lives. And it's tied into, you know, suburban mentalities and living in America, which is basically where I was brought up. So for me, it's kind of compassionate to relate a different place and a different culture in the same way I would relate this place and this culture, and try to give access and illuminate certain aspects of American life that might not be necessarily illuminated in our, you know, in our media and in the way that we are taught things.
Well, let's move on to another piece of yours. I think this is another piece where you'll be reading along with some video and music work. Mm-hmm. And can you say really quickly just what went into producing the video? And I don't mean like the technical video aspects, but like the music and, you know, like I think you worked with some other people on the music, and I don't know if you worked with other people on the video aspects or whatnot. So,
well, the music is composed with my friend Dave, who's here. And
Dave Ng, yeah.
Yes, Dave Ng. And the video is mostly me going back to India and trying to recreate certain things that I had written in the past several years from those Super 8 tapes that I had discovered in 2000.
Okay. All right, well, I'm going to move on to the next piece.
Two years ago, my mother's seer handed me a piece of lined paper my grandmother had torn out of a notebook. It was off-white with faded blue lines, wide rule for the ease of children learning how to write. He asked me to mark some dots on it, any way I wished. After looking at their arrangement for a few minutes, he went into a trance. His nose twitched. I had a hard time believing in him, but my mother and her mother and her mother's mother never had any doubts about him or his father or his father's father. He says I have a Nagadosham, like Nainama. Unlike karma, which is the fruit of what your soul did in its previous life, anagadosham is the result of prarabdha karma. Prarabdha karma is the fruit of your actions during this life. It is immediate retribution. Yesterday I found out the exact time I was born and told the pujari. Another pujari, across the bridge in Pumban, produced my birth chart with his computer. Over the phone, they discussed the details, where the stars shone when I was born, how they rested in the sky. They determined that there was no reason for me to do the Nagapratistha. If I was going to do the ritual, I first had to wash away the misfortune of being born in America with the waters of the Lakshmana Tirtham. I watched the boats in the ocean from the roof of the hotel. Their sails lined the horizon in red, white, and blue. Their wood slid past the water around them gently. The wind blew until they vanished. Closer, by the beach blackened by sewage, a man searched for empty water bottles and dogs barked. Behind them, fishing boats twirled in circles held by chains that wouldn't let them go. The pujari lives in a two-story building a few hundred yards away from the temple across the street from an internet cafe that has no internet. He greets us at the front door and motions us to go in. The front room is empty except for a square pit at one end for the fire of the puja. He hands me the chart and I realize that they had typed in my name as Rama, born in New York, U.S., St. Helena, instead of Amar, born in Ithaca, New York, U.S. The longitude and latitude is off by a few degrees, and they managed to reverse my name. These were not my stars. They belonged to someone else or no one at all. I decide not to tell him. He tells me to change into the clothes I bought for the ceremony in the back of the house. A pair of cotton pants, like pajamas, and a puncha, which is a wide scarf that covers your upper body. I wash my feet and hands with a small brass pitcher and watch the dirt from the Tirtham flow down a small channel into the open sewer that runs under his front doorstep, carrying a black effluent to the ocean. Where did this water come from? There's no well to be seen behind his house. The water under the island is full of salt. The pujari makes sure I throw the stems too. A car honks on the street. His baby screams from the back of the house. The flowers form questions in heaps. Their language is an area of color. I have no answers. I find it hard to understand their motives. Did they agree to perform the ritual because of money? I don't deserve their efforts. Nainama would. She bathed snakes with only the sky's protection. She knew what to ask. There are 8 pujaris now, and one of them, who hadn't noticed the camera and sat in front of it, slides to the right. When Anima was young, she slept on the floor. The roof was dirt and thatched and parsed with light. When the cobra came, she was dreaming of her future husband, her future son. Her father slept beside her, not dreaming, but only resting. The cobra watched Anima and then turned to look at him, so he decided to kill it. And later, outside, he set it on fire. You entered my house while we slept. You did not ask. There are no rats here for you, only us. I did what I had to, and now your skin is fanned and cracked across the wood. I see my face 1,000 times when the sun strikes your skin and the fire burns them away. Child, do you know what I whispered into your ear while you slept? If you remember, your life will be what it was meant to be. If you forget, your life will be lost, like many I have chosen not to forgive. I know this like you now know the dead shell of my body beside your feet. Father, do you know what you have done? If you did, you would have only pushed him away, not killed him who had done me no harm. What dreams you killed. What a life of debt I have. I nurture the mothers of snakes with milk and honey. I poured into the holes that are their homes in the morning, take a cold shower with my sari on when the sun rises, and when my children live, I'll make a cobra's eye out of silver and give it to them. When Nainama was young, she married my grandfather. Her eldest daughter remembered her today. She turned in front of her altar in the corner of the bedroom because her mother died in August years ago. There's a steel pitcher in the alcove she anointed with pusbu and kumkum that is as round as Nainama's face, as round as the widest part of her arms. I watched the TV fire shots in the air when she rung the bell, circled the air with incense. She's as tall as the small fridge by her bed. Because of a snake spirit, she said, Nainama's children died young, just like the young snake her father had killed. After four children had died, two boys and two girls, she asked everyone in town, why do my children die? Everyone she asked said that she had a Naga dosham. So she went to the new part of town where there was a huge snake hail with snakes as long as a man's arm. Every day she poured milk and honey on the hill, and then my aunt was born, and then my father, and both were small and frail but lived. She named them after Subramanyam Swami because they were his blessings to her. And until she died, she prayed to him by offering milk and honey to the cobras in the hill. At some point in your life, the seer said, your shadow fell upon a snake in the forest.
Thanks. You know, this section that you read here really gets to some of the questions we were kind of anticipating about 5 minutes ago. But it's interesting because the part that you read where your uncle kills a cobra that has come in and just kind of. And is just kind of resting there, and this is part of in this book that part becomes a kind of myth, the origin of this dosham, this Naga dosham, and immediately afterwards you read a part where the seer says that, you know, at some point in your life your shadow fell across a snake in the forest. And it's interesting how these myths kind of echo and echo and echo through this text in various different kind of manifestations. There's a lot of different parts where a snake is somehow killed or in retribution, some of your family members are feeding snakes milk and honey. And similarly to the video work that you do, a lot of the sound work and the way that the video is cut is creating these kind of echoes that then create new associative kind of leaps in the text across visually. So if you can talk to me about that a bit.
It's a sequence of correspondences, right? And they're not concrete per se, because I have to at some point accept that they do have some sort of effect on me, right? Because this is my grandmother, and she feels that if she had never appeased the dosham that she was under, my dad would have never been born. If you ask my dad about this, he would say that everyone in South India believes something like this and that he doesn't think that it matters at all. But then if you ask my mom about it, it's something altogether different, where she feels that there's more to that than anything else and that it has to be dealt with. And so then there's me, right, who has to at some point choose and decide what I'm going to do in terms of that. And it's always been my position that even if I'm skeptical, I can't set aside like the story or the narrative, which has more to do with the people in an environment as opposed to people coming to terms with some sort of faith.
Well, and that's, you talked earlier about your skepticism towards these things, and I think in a way what's great about this text is you don't kind of come out right at the beginning and say, I'm really skeptical of all this. But there's a certain kind of distance that you maintain in the text that actually seems to allow you the ability to open up these meanings in some kind of poetic manner. And I wonder about this place that you reached where it becomes not the fact that, you know, what narrative that anyone subscribes to, but the fact that all of us are kind of carrying around, you know, our own narratives, and they, like your father and your mother, somehow those two narratives are not clashing, but mixing together, and you're having to find a place within that. So I guess I wonder if you feel like you've kind of dropped a certain level of skepticism, or if that's still maintained.
Well, I mean, I have to clarify what I mean by skepticism is that I'm skeptical of cause and effect. Like, something I do will have an effect. But I'm not skeptical about the relationship between these stories and how I've ended up where I am. Those narratives have formed more than just me. They've formed the historical and cultural notions that my family speaks about.
So in this piece, in a beautiful way too, what we haven't mentioned yet is the way that, and it's not arbitrary at all, it flows all together quite naturally, where you bring in the Californian history about the local tribes around where your family was living, the Maidu and the Bear Dance and that stuff. If you could talk about how you became involved with that, and what was the spark that made you realize these things are connected? Or
well, so the Maidu live in Northern California near the Lake Tahoe area, and at a certain point in my life, I was introduced to their community, and a lot of the similarities in how they viewed colonialism, how trains affected their lives during the expansion to the West by the pioneers, and how India itself is crisscrossed by British colonialism, like these sort of concordances nudged me to look at how their narratives also affected them, specifically their notions of myths and stories that were founded in the environment around them, which I found similar in a certain way to how the environment affected the people in South India that I had come from.
So would you say then that, I mean, you've been talking about not so much belief, but just in a way the necessity of following the narrative or relating the narrative or not relating the narrative at certain points. So in a way I feel like in this piece those things ultimately do operate like belief.
Well, I mean, it's the same, I guess it's similar to what I'm skeptical about and what I'm not, right? I'm open to having an understanding of history, but it's not anything more than that. But in a certain way, history is all we have. So if we ignore it or decide it's not ours, then there are certain things that are veiled for us. And I think that has a lot to do with what I experienced growing up in a suburban community in a tract home.
Yeah, and in this piece as well, it's you talk about not losing history and not losing particularly like, or for any one person, not to totally ignore one's own history. But in this book, not only do you tell like your own history, but you seem to take up the history of the Maidu people. And really, I mean, I can't imagine the amount of information about the Maidu people you just kind of picked up. And I wonder what kind of research you did to kind of get that whole story.
I wouldn't say I just picked it up. it was given to me. And in the same way, these stories that I'm performing or putting into or publishing are given to people. And that is, I guess, compassionate, right? In the sense that if the history of oppressed people are overlooked, then that is an injustice that you're committing itself, right? And so, you know, that, I mean, that's part of the dynamics of a text like this, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, the text in this American Canon is in this way rather generous, because not only are you retelling maybe your own history and the history of your family, but you're showing links between the way that, that myth and history is kind of passed down, whether it, and kind of irrespective of if the, not totally divorced from its particularities, but you're showing the ways in which history goes through its own transformations, and you're being really generous also in giving us your history and then picking up or being given also and reflecting back a completely different narrative, but showing us the connections between them. So that's, I think that's great. Do we want to do, let's move on to another reading. I think this is without, this is just straight reading, yeah?
Yeah, this is just straight reading.
Oh my goodness. Without a net.
Oh dear. Two hours, 10 minutes, 35 seconds, and zero frames. This is a town of pilgrims and sages. One of the pujaris, who sits next to Chandra by the door, speaks Telugu. Chandra turns to him to translate. He looks at me and says, "You have a sarpa dosham. So when you offer flowers, ask for forgiveness from the snake you killed. Pray to her. Ask for what you want. If you know your Kula Devi, pray to her too. She is upset because you have ignored her. When you finish here and return home, perform a puja at your Kula Devi's temple. I will find out later that a Kula Devi is a local goddess specific to your ancestral home. I will think it is Pudalama, but Pedatta will tell me it is another one on a hill above Pudali. JJ built this temple, and our family is the only one that goes there. The next time I return, I will walk up that hill. One ritual leads to others as you progress through the deaths of your families and end up at your own. They hand me the harati and ask me to turn it around the Navagrahas and then bless the small fire burning in ghee three times. I show devotion through rotations. The proof, which is the smoke suspended in the air between the world and another, disappears. I had expected to perform a ritual for the first time without my parents when my father died. Only sons and brothers are allowed to observe and participate. After the cremation, bits of bones that survived the fire are collected, called flowers, and are scattered in the river. They ask me to pray. I close my eyes. JJ owned a small farm on the outskirts of town when my father was young. When I visit, Pedatta is afraid that I'll get lost. My father had lost his way to the farm as a child, and she thinks I'm as bookish as him. I don't think I could get lost here. There's only one main road. People tell me that JJ showed up one day and set up a bidi stall. When his father had died, the eldest brother, Subaraidu, inherited the house in Markapur and kicked the rest of the brothers out. I wanted to see the well of my grandfather's family in Gajalukunda, but they told me none exists. I would find people who never knew our history and a small dry river near a few thatched roofs. The stall carried more products over the years, from bidis to mitapan to cigarettes to pots and pans. He adopted his two nephews and took care of his sister-in-law, Gurama, when his second eldest brother died. JJ never spoke to Subaraidu after what had happened in Markapur. In 1992, he couldn't talk. Sounds from the road surrounded his body, made still by age and the old cot at the top of the stairs on the balcony. His legs and arms were like figs that had fallen from their branches weeks before. Two hours, 10 minutes, 38 seconds, and zero frames. Your eyes reflect what you can't express by holding my hand. The bell rings in the temple you built behind your house that you will fall asleep in, waking up in a place where my hand is gone. I visited your other brother, Pichaya, in his house in Markapur. A heart attack made him silent, and he was lying on a twine and wood cot half in the shade of the front porch of his house. He used to give me chalk and slate boards from his small factory. I liked the wood frames they had and the variety of chalks he would give us. His eyes reflected a love that he expressed by crying. 2 years later, I'll get a telegram. You died in your sleep with a smile on your face. You didn't talk to your nephew, the one who was born years ago unable to speak, but you watched him grow up like a slow tree that bears the quietest of fruit. Your son took me from your old wood cot to your nephew's and told me, "See our cousins across the street? The rest of the family ignores them because of what their father did years ago. But the price he paid was more than our silence. His only son was born unable to speak. He spent 60 years of his life ringing the bell at school. That is all he can do. After so many years, when I ran past your house to play on the hand-cranked Ferris wheel on its summer tour through towns like this, one where everyone is afraid that the wheel will break, spilling us onto the dirt, I met you. When I looked into your eyes, you didn't see what we shared. You died on your cot, and sounds faded around you, of chalk on slate, the ring of a bell, lids falling on eyes. Two hours, 11 minutes, 20 seconds, and zero frames. I keep my eyes closed. Around me, they are waiting, cross-legged before the blue wall or next to Chandra in front of the pink one. Where the two colors meet in the corner of the room, there is nothing but empty space. They ask me to pray, but I have nothing left to ask. I wait for my memories to finish jogging. For a decade, the India I never knew changed. Under the balance in the cabinet of his shop, JJ has still kept 3 silver coins from the turn of the century for luck. When he looked out into the street, my India was there to greet him. The balcony at the top of the stairs was no longer there. The floor fell off into the air above the road. A few metal rods, once held in concrete, dangled where a wall used to be. Across the street, the neighbor was staring out of what once was the front of his house. All our balconies had disappeared, leaving us open to the road below.
Thanks. Amar, when I was reading this, as I'm thinking about it now, even still, and Matt mentioned this, about the layering of stories and history and personal myths and collective myths and what's really underneath your floor and things like this. And how the book is layered too in the 3 sections, karma, maya, and atma. And it made me think of first the importance of local history, the kind of subtle excavation that you do when you look into the history surrounding where your family lives in Northern California. As I said, what is really underneath a house? But also how this opens up or is opened up by something that spans quite a distance across the earth. And I guess I was wondering, was there a point when you felt this power of this local place, and yet at the same time this expansion across distance, across time?
An example would be, local in terms of who I am, right? Looking into that. I mean, it always gives you access into everything around you, all the people that you've met, all the things that you've learned. And, you know, as a sort of naive, youthful notion, I'd always assumed that empire and colonialism was something that affected a certain group of people, let's say Indians. But culpability was really opened up to me when I started looking into what Indian people were doing during a lot of wars. For example, when Iraq was initially taken over by the British in the teens, it was Indian soldiers that were used to oppress the Iraqi people. And if you look back at the Boxer Revolution in China, it was also Indian soldiers that were used to quell that uprising. And so, I mean, this relationship, just looking into a supposed, I mean, a general local, but a local that I had have an identity with, and then seeing how that locality is spread out across and used by and a part of every other per se locality like Empire or England or America really blew open a lot of those distinctions and barriers and pointed out how even me being here in America was very similar to someone being in India at the same time, so to speak.
That's great. Well, I think we're going to take a short break and then come back and open the floor up for some audience questions, have just a couple more shorter readings, and that'll be that. So thank you very much, Amar.
Thank you.